following interview was recorded in the year 2017 by the Gawler Community Broadcasting Association as part of the Gawler Oral History Interview Project.
Today I'm talking with Jeanette Manhennett. Jeanette is a self-published author. She is actively involved in the Gawler Writers Group, researching history, promoting community broadcasting, being a mum, and a host of other community activities. She has many stories to tell, but today we are going to focus on her interest in history and a book she wrote called The Gate. This book is a fictionalised account of a family from the Mallee and their personal experiences of the Great Depression in Australia. More than that, it's a story of a young girl named Mags. Welcome, Jeanette.
Hi.
I'm really pleased to be talking to you today, but look, I understand your interest in history and writing started probably from a fairly early age. I wonder if you can tell us about where you were born and growing up and a bit about your schooling.
I was born in Ballarat, which is where history is just all around you. Yeah. My grandmother went to the same primary school as I did. And in fact, our house was next door to my grandparents' house, which had been a shop where my grandmother was going to school. So I had that history just all around me growing up. The mine shaft would open up in neighbours' backyards. And I grew up with a keen awareness of history. My parents were both storytellers, my mother especially. I learnt a wealth of Australian history, especially about the Depression, from my mother, because she would tell stories about their experience of depression. So that was a history I grew up with, was the history of the Depression in Australia.
Can you recall any of those little stories she might have told?
Or? Well, I'll tell the one. About the racehorse and losing their house.
Yeah.
They'd moved down to Melbourne to Sunshine and bought a new house. My grandfather was a bricklayer. And at that time, there was a building boom. Being a bricklayer was quite prosperous for a working class person, and my grandmother thought she'd married well. And they'd bought a new house. They were paying it off. They'd got to second last payment to make, so they had two more payments to make. And he had a dream about a horse winning. Now, the family stories varies. They all say it's Farlap and it was the Melbourne Cup, but it couldn't have been because the year was wrong.
Isn't that a lovely dream?
It wasn't a Farlap, it wasn't the Melbourne Cup. But he was sure this horse was going to win. And the only money he had to put on the horse was the mortgage payment for the house. And my grandmother put her hands on her hips and said, "You are not going to jeopardise the family house over a racehorse." So my grandfather went to work past the betting shop and looked in wistfully, and he was tempted, but he was too scared of his wife, I think, and so he didn't go in and put the money on the horse. And the horse did win. And if he had put the money on the horse, he would have won enough to pay for the house. He lost his job that week, and they couldn't make the final payment. So the bank foreclosed, and they lost the lot. The house, all the money they'd paid, when the bank foreclosed, they got nothing back. So they one payment off paying for the house and they lost the lot. And they were homeless. So they would have ended up in La Perouse, not La Perouse, the shanty town down by the Yarra. Mm. But my grandmother's father had been a butcher and tight-fisted with money all his life. But he had enough. He was able to buy them a little cottage in Ballarat. So they moved back to Ballarat and lived in a miner's cottage. And then that was burnt down. Of course, it wasn't insured because they couldn't afford house insurance. So they lost a second home. So they spent a lot of the Depression living on shoeboxes and managed to acquire another house and pay it off. But life is always tough.
So these are powerful stories in the family history.
Yes.
It's not a bad motivator for writing the book you have eventually written.
No, that's right. So when I started writing, it began with an essay I did at high school, which wasn't particularly set anywhere in any time. And when I wanted to take that story further, a little bit of research, I discovered the Mallee was the perfect setting for it. My father grew up in the Mallee. He lived in a place called Ruineen, which I changed around to be Ruineen in the novel.
Yes.
His father was a station master there, so he also would talk about the dust storms and tell lots of stories of the Mallee. He'd loved living in the Mallee as a child. So I had his Mallee stories as well. So I drew on both when I wrote.
So you had this family history and you're going to school. Whereabouts did you go to school?
Ballarat.
Ballarat, okay. And secondary schooling there as well?
Yes.
And how did you go at school?
Very good in English and history. I loved history.
There you go.
Yes. It was when, really, I think, when I started to do history that I got excited about education.
Really, yeah.
And it had realised by the end of school that it was going to be English history were the subjects I was going to go on with when I finally did decide to go on.
Yeah. Did you have any teachers who supported you or who inspired you through that period?
Year 11 English teacher. I think most of our English teachers were very good.
Yeah.
And year 12, no, we didn't have very inspiring teachers at all, unfortunately. Yeah. Yeah. I learnt, in fact, I did Australian history in year 12 and I learnt it all from a series of historical Australian historical novels, not from what I learnt in class. Mm. So. Yeah.
And you went on to university education?
I went off overseas for about 4 years after school. Fantastic. And backpacked around and travelled and then came back. And while I was overseas, that I decided to go to Flinders in South Australia, pretty much almost choosing South Australia with a pin on the map, and came back, enrolled into Flinders, had 6 months to wait. So I travelled around Australia for 6 months before I started uni and I've been South Australian ever since.
Yes, yeah. When did you move to Gawler?
We moved to Gawler back in 95, before our first son was born.
Yeah.
We'd both just finished uni. Justin had just got a job in defence. Mm. And so we were buying into the housing market at the bottom end back then because of our age and because, you know, we'd been older students.
Yeah.
And we pretty much looked along the train lines at where we could afford to buy. And somebody he worked with suggested Gawler. We wanted an old cottage. He came out, looked at stone cottages, and we made the decision there and then. We moved to Gawler and buy a stone cottage, which we still haven't renovated and badly in need of it. But
Well, clearly you're too busy in your community activities to spend much time on renovation, I would think.
I discovered that neither of us are actually home handyman types after we...
Oh, that's brilliant. Mm. Yeah. Well, we covered a little bit about your early days and your schooling and whatever. But The Gate was published in 2012, but clearly the germ of the idea for The Gate started much earlier. Can you take us through that story?
Yeah. Well, really, from the time I wrote the short story at school, it was in my head for years, so all the time travelling.
Yeah.
It was a story I was developing and it was growing in my head. And when I was at uni, I decided to actually start writing it. Which was fortunate because I had the benefit of uni library for research, so I was able to access books from the library that I wouldn't have been able to find anywhere else. So Egan Kitcher's Landfall, that's really hard to get. I've never been able to buy a copy. I only bought that book about him about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have found that anywhere else but a university library. So that was fortunate. So I did a lot of the initial research when I was still at uni, and drafts one. Justin accidentally wiped everything on the computer, including my novel. He managed to retrieve it. Another time it was on a hard drive that died on an old laptop and he managed again to retrieve it. So I lost it twice and got it back.
Yeah.
And then I learnt to back up after that, have multiple backups. So I worked on it for years after when Angus was born, I decided to stop working for a while and concentrate on writing novels. So I use the children as an excuse to stay home and write. And I've written other novels as well and drafts. I've got numerous drafts of different books. But The Gate has been one I've just come back to again and again because it is a favourite.
Oh, I can see that.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a wonderful, wonderful story. Mm-hmm. So it's... But getting to the publishing, because it's self-published, isn't it?
Yes, A few years ago, a friend persuaded me to try and get it published.
Yeah.
And we approached agents and it was really at the stage where agents just weren't taking on any new writers.
Yeah.
So we didn't have any luck there and I let it sit for a little while and then it was really Justin, my partner, that said, no, you've got to get this published. So we looked at self-publishing and because you've got the problem of selling. It's very difficult to market with a self-published book, but at least it's out there. And,
yes.
Yeah, that's a slow process, I think,
which I'm working on. Would you mind if I actually got you to read, say, a page from the book?
That's fine.
And then we're going to talk about, in detail, you know, that particular era in Australia. Because I think, as we discussed earlier, that it's a period of time that we don't seem to discuss or analyse a lot in Australian history. Yet it was really important, wasn't it?
It was. Mm. It's a really interesting period. And I think, as school history go, teaching this to school kids, they would really enjoy it because there's great stories to be told and big personalities, but there's also the personal history, which is very interesting as well.
Yeah.
So it has that human-centric side to it, which a lot of history lacks, which I think is really engaging.
Yeah. Good on you. Well, there's a little section here. I wonder if I could just pass that to you and if you can have a go at reading that.
There was an arch over the road that led into Shantytown, a crude simulation of the triumphal marble arch which had recently been erected on the western approach to the city. Someone had painted in bold green lettering across it, "Welcome to Shantytown." Below those words, someone had scribbled, "The land fit for heroes." A grim reminder that many of the homeless men had fought in Gallipoli and Flanders and been promised rich rewards for their sacrifice. Although it was school hours, a small group of ragged children played hopscotch in the muddy ground near the gate. School attendance was a matter of indifference in Shantytown. As diseases such as diphtheria, polio, whooping cough and tuberculosis were rampant, schools didn't particularly welcome the children of the refuse settlement. Some of the children were chanting the words of a new song as they circled about a length of rope. "We're on the susso now, we can't afford a cow, we live in a tent, we pay no rent, we're on the susso now." Many of the men were out or away seeking work or scrounging. Some, who had given up never really cared, lounged about, hands dangling idly by their sides, chewing on bark. There was a card game going on outside one shanty, and a small group of spectators had gathered to watch. There were women, mostly engaged in various domestic chores. It was incumbent upon them to maintain the cleanliness of their families amid all the filth, to keep their floors swept and to uphold the domestic standards in which they had been bred, though they had to defecate in a creek.
Thank you, Jeanette, for that. That's Shantytown. So it's really interesting. This is Australia in the 30s.
Yes.
And who would imagine now or think now? They were...
Every city.
Every city.
In Sydney, the shantytown was called La Perouse.
Yeah.
And I've forgotten there was one by the Yarra in Melbourne where mother's family would have ended up, but for the generosity of a grandfather.
Mm.
They would, and Ballarat had one down by the Yarra Ree Creek by the dump, which is the one I've described here.
Yeah.
So
there were shanty towns and on the susso. Talk about on the susso, because that's a term, I mean, I'd completely forgotten about it.
Mm. It was the term for being on the dole, on the susso. In fact, I think the susso was, it was a government handout. To begin with, they were only handing out food rations. They weren't actually giving the unemployed money at all, which, of course, was impossible. And a lot of people lost homes. Foreclosures were commonplace. And there were battles. There were people that would go around and try and fight the police as they kicked out the families living in the houses. So that battle I described as well.
Yes.
And helped people get their belongings out of the house and away from the police.
So there was quite a bit of conflict and even violence a lot of conflict. In Australia
at the time. Yes, there was a lot of conflict. It was a more violent time in general than now. I mean, people talk about violence now, but the past was much more violent.
Yeah.
And people were more inclined to hit, punch, to get into physical fights than they would be now as well.
Yeah. I think one of the main characters in your book where you explore these themes about the violence and the shanty towns relates to Pat. And I find Pat a really interesting character. And I think the way you actually utilise him to explore these things of the life of the swaggy, the susso. Mm. I think really works well. So tell me a bit about Pat. What drove this character?
A little bit inspired by my grandfather, I guess, who was a communist during that era and had to go away and find work.
Yes.
And was a romantic. But Pat is very much a fictional character as well. He's sort of very... very much a fictional character. A character I liked. And
yeah. No, I really love that character. It's good. Yes. We'll get to Mags, who's the main character, in a second. But let's go back to the early days of the Mallee. because the book is centred around this, I guess, this family and the Mallee. Can you talk a bit about how these settlements came about and the type of land that they lived in?
The land was, well, it was scrub when it was first settled, and back then people believed that if you cleared the trees and planted crops, the rains would come. It was a popular belief that rains followed the plough, and it was a saying, American saying, that was adopted in Australia. It was certainly very common in South Australia, if we'd certainly been reading up on. But it was that same idea that you could make the land fertile and productive. The problem wasn't with the land, it was just with, you know, you weren't putting enough sweat into it if it wasn't working. So it was that mentality that they divided up the Mallee and started to sell it in allotments through the Closer Settlement Board, which was aimed to settle the Mallee. It was created to settle the Mallee and to mortgage, give these mortgage parcels of land, which would then be probably not dissimilar to the original land sales in South Australia, the original settlement of South Australia, similar in principle. They were small lots. They weren't big enough to be productive, similar as within South Australia. And, of course, the irrigation schemes that they promised didn't eventuate. So there was always, of course, rumours that corruption and so-and-so got irrigation and we didn't because they're friends with so-and-so. But there was never really, I think, enough money or enough care from higher up to carry on with the schemes that were promised.
And these people who settled there, were they experienced farmers? Or were they...
A lot weren't, no. Because, again, as with the early settlement of South Australia, anyone could take up land. As long as they were married and respectable. Or they preferred married people. They liked people to be respectable. They didn't care too much about knowledge of farming. So a lot had no knowledge of farming. A lot had no knowledge of farming in a desert arid region, like the Mallee, in marginal land, which is a whole different kettle of fish again to farming in the south. So
from your research, I mean, with all these families settling in the Mallee, what happened when droughts hit and eventually the Depression broke?
A lot just walked away. A lot walked away. They just had to. They'd change their names, go to the city, get a job because they couldn't keep up with the payments. It became impossible. And there was, during the Depression, there were some real disasters hit. There was the drought.
Yes.
Then there was the Buy More Wheat campaign, when the Scullion government decided that to stimulate the economy, they get all the Australian wheat farmers to grow more wheat. And so they turned all their land over to wheat crop. They had a bumper season. They had the best rains. They had the best season in years. But the world economy had crashed and nobody could afford to buy Australian wheat. So these huge... And back then it was kept in stacks. They didn't, it was before the silos.
Yep.
So these huge wheat stacks by all the stations. And, of course, the mice got in. My father would tell tales about the mouse plagues. The mouse plague of the Mallee, they'd put the legs of the tables in tins full of water to stop the mice getting onto the table. And in the morning they'd come out and the tins would be full of dead mice and the mice would be running up to the table over the bodies of the dead mice. So they got into everything.
That would have been a remarkably heartbreaking experience.
It was, yes.
And so they had a bumpy year.
And they couldn't sell the wheat.
They couldn't sell it.
And the government had promised they'd buy it for a set price.
Yeah.
And the Reserve Bank, under the leadership of Menzies, refused to honour that. And so the government couldn't get the money. The bank wouldn't release the money, so the government wasn't able to pay. And I think in the end they did pay reduced price, which impoverished the government because the wheat by then was rubbish. It was unusable.
Yes,
yeah. So
inevitably, families had no choice.
No.
They had to just leave.
Leave, yes. A lot didn't survive through that time.
And I think you cover in your book certainly the stories about families broke up, fathers went off to try and find work.
Often never returned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. And so that leads into your stories about the swaggies who appeared to be everywhere. So,
yes, the new pestilence like flies at that time. There were so many people that couldn't get work. And so men would walk from Victoria to New South Wales. Australian author, can't think, my brother Jack.
Oh, okay.
His brother walked to New South Wales and back to Victoria. And so, but then they'd be crossing paths with men from New South Wales coming down to Victoria because they'd hear there was work somewhere. There'd always be rumours, if you go there, there'll be work. Yeah. And so the whole countryside was people
on the move.
Yeah, and because they didn't find work, so they depended on charity of the countryside. Yeah. And after a few years, that charity began to wear thin because of the over-demand. Yeah.
So were there charitable organisations, or did they just knock on doors?
Knocked on doors. There would have been charitable organisations, but they were overstrained. Mm. Yes. They couldn't cope with the demand. Mm. So a lot was just knocking on people's doors and hoping some would send them away, some would give them a crust or do a day's work for me and I'll feed you. And
that leads into another thing you talk about, and that the concept of underground mutton.
Yes.
talk to us about that.
Underground mutton was one of the chief dietary items, rabbit. Yeah. And the government had a bounty, so people, you'd get not just the meat, but you'd get money from the government for killing them because of the rabbit plagues at the time.
Mm.
And there's photos of people in Melbourne, vendors with selling rabbit carcasses. So underground mutton was the meat of the period. That's what they lived on. And it was plentiful.
So without those rabbits...
People would have starved.
That's true, isn't it?
Mm, it is.
Starvation.
Yes, yeah. So rabbits did keep people alive, so they did serve some function during the Depression.
Yeah. Now, there are other terms you use in the book, but just let me refer to... So we're talking about the underground mutton and on the Soso. Talk to us again about the Closer Settlement Board.
The Closer Settlement Board was set up to oversee the settlement of the Mallee and Rimra too, I think. It was Mallee and Rimra. And they were hated because they were inflexible. They didn't allow, it's a drought year, we'll let you off for this year.
So this is a government administration?
It was a government administered organisation. It has been some years since I did the research, so I'm not quite as fresh with it as I was.
Yeah.
In fact, when I first saw the CSB, what is CSB? Yes. And then I realised, readers won't know either. So I had to add that little bit more explanation in when I re-edited it. And they pretty much were like a police force, almost a mortgagee, because they held the mortgages to the farms. So it was a, payment over years to pay off the farm, which very few people ever achieved.
So that's why they changed their name when they walked off the property, because...
Yes, the Closer Settlement Board would follow them because they owed money.
That would have been too.
They left the farm owing money.
They had nothing.
No, and they were in debt. Yeah, and they were in debt, which they had no means of possibly paying off.
Yes.
So...
Now, another lovely thing you talk about in the book is the importance of horse racing back in those times.
Yes.
Can you just discuss that?
Yeah. My family weren't particularly sporting, but horse races were always important. And my grandfather loved Farlap. So when I was a child, every time we went to Melbourne, I'd go to the museum to see Farlap in the museum. They did really take an interest in horse racing. It was the passion of, I think, every class of society in Australia. Hence all the public holidays for horse races.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it?
Mm. I don't know that other countries do that.
I guess the only thing that's passed on from that era now, we have the Melbourne Cup. That's probably the only time in Australia we all go, horse racing.
Mm.
But I think what you discuss in your book is clearly back in the 20s and the 30s, everyone followed.
And you had the little town had horse races, all the towns. And that was a gala event. That's when everybody would come together for the local horse race.
Yeah.
So the book does begin with a horse race.
Yeah. And champion jockeys would have been the heroes of the day and all this. Lovely, lovely stuff. How about jumping the rattler? Talk about this.
Jumping the rattler is classic 30s. They couldn't afford train fares, so they would jump the rattler, jump the train in the night and travel. And that was common form of transport, and I've heard stories now of someone waking up with a bull in the carriage with them and things that did happen.
It is interesting though, isn't it, with American history, that they've almost there's almost a very romantic notion of their tramps using the trains, but we don't seem to hear much about it. It was still just as big in Australia.
It was huge during the Depression. It was the means of transport for a lot of people, the only available means of transport they had, other than walking and wearing out shoe leather.
Yep, jump on a good train.
In the night. Mm. And they did start to police them. So they did start to have police searching the trains Depression progressed, yes. Mm. So they had to be on the listen out for the police. And
We always like to blame the victims, don't we?
Yes, that's right.
And there was an organisation called the Labour Bureau. Do you remember talking about that? And
Going to get work, yes. Yeah. And the queues at the Labour Bureau, and it would be pointless. They'd just queue all day and not get work. But it sort of said it gave them a sense of they were trying.
Yes.
By queuing, yeah. I suppose they got the sense of at least we're trying. But there was a real despair. People didn't understand what was happening. Yeah. They didn't grasp the economics. Very few would have grasped it. And it must have seemed like Armageddon to a lot of people, the end of the world. It just, and up until then, there was also this culture, work ethic. Australia had this strong work ethic, and men had to work. It was part of their, you know, being a man was working. So it, psychologically, it was really damaging and destructive.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, as you mentioned, a lot of these men had come back from the war.
Yes.
Supposedly. Yeah.
To a land fit for heroes,
Well, of course, they were struggling.
Mallee, the closest settlement board, opened up more land for soldier settlers.
Yeah.
And because these are men, they're war damaged, they're traumatised, they know nothing about farming. And this, and one of the theories is that the reason that so many of the soldier settlements were arid, marginal lands, well away from the capital, governments didn't want war-hardened men coming back to their cities. They knew they were going to be trouble. So they actually pushed them as far away as they could into this infertile land.
Isolated them.
And isolated them.
Mm.
So.
Very sad.
It is.
And amongst all this, in this period of the Great Depression, which literally even the major economists on the planet really didn't know how to fix.
No.
In Australia, we actually had a visit by someone by the name of Sir Otto Nehemiah. Can you talk about this man?
When Pat goes to the barbers, the barber talks about the Otto and mispronounces the name.
Yes.
He came over. He was a German economist, what we now think of as a right-wing economist, and he advocated austerity measures and cutting government spending, which, of course, was the worst possible thing to do.
Yeah. So we're already in a depression, he was saying. Grind it down even further.
Meanwhile, at the same time, Keynes in England, Keynesian economics, he was developing Keynesian economics, which is pump money in, stimulate the economy, and get money moving.
Yes.
So, and pump it in at the bottom because it rises up. And there's still the trickle-down theory. It's scary how much of it is still relevant today.
That's true. Now, in amongst all this, you're writing the story and you've got your major character, heroine, I guess, that starts off, Mags starts off in the book very young, and I guess she grows and matures through the Depression in the late 30s and whatever. The inspiration for Mags, can you talk about...
I think as a teenager she was the ultra ego, the person I would like to have been, the opposite to me. She was the, you know, the ideal that I would like to have been, but... Yeah. So I think, you know, writing this starting it as a teenager, she grew in my head when I was a teenager. She was that, you know, ideal of what I would love to have been, you know, the extrovert, the bold redhead. I always wished I had red hair.
So even when you were young and this book was playing in your head, was she the central character
back then? She was the central character back then. And when I wrote it, I felt that I needed to develop the father more and follow his storyline as well too. Yeah. So he had been less central originally than...
Look, and that's really interesting because he does emerge as a powerful part of the book, and, as I said, and I love both those characters. There's another one, and that's Mr. Bardley, this idealist teacher who comes into town. Can you talk about him?
As a teenager, I admired my teachers a lot.
Yeah.
And I think he was supposed to be the educated, the cultured person that comes in, the sort of hero figure.
Yeah.
So, and that inspires them and that gets them, teaches them the value of education. And a good teacher was absolutely treasured because they didn't always get good teachers, and a bad teacher in a country town like that would be the end for that school, destructive. So having a good teacher, and usually they'd move on fairly quickly, they didn't stay long either. So a good teacher that stays.
So the story develops with Mags and I guess her experiences. And look, it's a life story based in really harsh times.
Yes.
But it comes through, and one of the things I'd love you to discuss a little bit is that pre-World War II in Australia and probably across Europe and also the US, things like communism and fascism were probably very widely discussed, and there were very strong sympathisers for both camps.
There was the economic conditions pushed people to extreme political views. My grandfather, for for instance,
yes.
had very strong political views through that period. He always had, but that pushed him, I think, further to the left.
Mm,
he already was left, but it pushed him further that way. But in my research, that came across so strongly, just how divided society was on political fault lines and how passionate people were about politics at the time. They're much more passionate about it then. Yes. I'm beginning to get a little bit of that now with extremes coming back into play. It's a little bit scary, actually.
Very polarised viewpoints.
Because we're beginning to see the polarisation of viewpoints again happening. But yes, really polarised viewpoints. And I found a really intriguing book that talked about a white army in Victoria. And the author was doing research for a PhD thesis. He couldn't complete it because he couldn't get concrete evidence for it. But he talked to people. He had a lot of eyewitness accounts.
Yes.
But because for PhD you can't just rely on eyewitness accounts. Mm. So he published it as a book, and there was pretty compelling evidence that there was a white army, and there was a night where they manned the water tanks, and because they were told that there was going to be a communist Catholic uprising, which communists and Catholics hated each other at the time, so the likelihood of that. But they passionately believed it. And he said a lot of them were a little bit ashamed of it later, that they realised they'd been completely duped. But that was, especially through the Mallee and Rimwe, where they were struggling and hard times, and people really latched on to that idea that there was going to be this revolution. Things felt so precarious, I think.
A passionate, violent, emotional time in Australia.
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was.
And it led into this other thing, because prior to World War II, there was a Spanish Civil War.
Yes.
And you make mention, I think, is it the International Brigade?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that and Australia's involvement?
I think, just give a little bit of background about the Spanish Civil War. Spain had elected a socialist government to power, and there was a right-wing uprising against government and the royal family. Mm. So this was a rebellion by a right-wing military group under the leader, Franco, Generalissimo Franco.
Yes.
And the left in Spain, the government, appealed to the world for help. And all the world governments turned around and said, no, you're on your own. We're not going to defend you. Germany came in, and Italy, because they were just building up their army, building up their fascist muscles, came in on the side of Franco. So for the left and politically aware people around the world, this wasn't just a fight for Spain. This was a fight against fascist Germany. It was a fight against fascism. Mm. And they could see where that was leading.
Yep.
So all around the world, people joined an international brigade that was set up to go in and fight against Franco in Spain.
Yeah.
And that had factional problems. George Orwell wrote a very famous book, Homage to Catalonia, which is pretty damning about the international brigade.
Yes.
And so they turned on their own side, but...
Mm.
Which probably has some truth too.
Well, it was probably Stalin, an amateurish affair.
Well, Stalin was funding the International Brigade.
Oh, okay.
And basically it had to play to his rules. So he probably corrupted the whole thing. But it was very idealistic. The people that went to fight were very idealistic. And unfortunately, in the end they lost. But they were pretty much, they had to leave undercover. It was illegal. Government said it was illegal for anyone to join the International Brigade. So,
is that right?
Yes.
But a lot of Australians did join, didn't they?
Australians did join, probably unknown how many, because, of course, it was illegal, so it wasn't talked about. But they did say there were ships leaving harbour with an unusual amount of sailors on board, because they would sign on as sailors to leave the country.
So you would think somewhere there must be a lot of family stories which...
you would think so,
Supposedly hidden away, because we hear very little of that.
We do, People don't talk much about it, which is quite a shame, because I think it's still got relevance. And I think one of the things that's important is to see how our governments were complicit with fascism prior to World War II.
Yeah.
That they, and, you know, I think that is particularly relevant right now.
Yes, yeah.
That we can't afford to be complicit with other governments, no matter how powerful, if they're acting unethically.
Yeah. So this book, which took many years in the making. It actually encompasses the history of Australia, which we actually very rarely talk about or you appreciate. Can actually very rarely read about. There are a whole range of characters in this book. So the building up of these characters, how much work did that in involve you? But, you know.
Oh, probably a lot. A lot goes on in the head too. You know, it's not just sitting at a computer writing.
Yeah.
A lot of it is like out in the garden, be thinking about it, or doing, you know, other chores and thinking about it. Working, when I used to work, I used to be thinking about my stories. Because, so with any book, and I've got books in my head that haven't hit screen, paper, whatever yet, but they develop over time in my head, and I get very attached to my characters. So I get very attached. I got really attached to the characters in The Gate.
So do these characters, do they start to become real? I mean, it's...
yes, yeah.
Talk to them.
And also, play that Ruruna, of course, is sort of semi-based on Ballarat, but it's actually geographically shifted because the train line from Swan Hill doesn't go through Ballarat. That was my era at the time.
Yeah.
But I began to think of Ballarat as a Ruruna.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of Ballarat.
Yeah.
So, yeah, place names changed in my head as well.
This Mallee area we're talking about, or where the book is focused, can you just mention that?
I refer to it as Emptiest Victoria, I think, in the book. It's the north western corner of Victoria. And, of course, the Mallee, well, technically Gawler was Mallee at one stage.
Oh, okay.
Interestingly. Yeah. Pretty much, it was Mallee Scrub. So it really refers to that arid region, sort of semi-arid region of Australia, where Mallee Scrub grows. So it's named. So the Mallee really stretches across Victoria and South Australia.
Yeah.
And after the war, World War II, it did become prosperous. Those that were able to hold on began to, they had a few good years, and they began to actually consolidate and succeed. But
Jeanette, can I thank you very much?
That's
this
great.
Was a wonderful story, and can I say I really enjoyed the book and the history that's in there. So thank you again.
Thank you.
This interview, recorded in the year 2017 by the Gawler Community Broadcasting Association, is available for download for purposes of educational research. We expect that any creative written or electronic work derived from the recording gives due credit to the interviewee, interviewer, and GBA.